All right, good morning. So today we're going to talk about the OpenGL API. We've been looking at GLSL, the shading language, but we're going to look a little bit at the API. I'll give you some history about it, and we'll really talk about how do we launch shaders. We'll probably spend today and Wednesday talking about the OpenGL API. It's a huge API with literally with hundreds of functions, even thousands of functions if we count some of the old stuff. We're not going to go over all of them, but I want to give you guys enough foundation so that you could understand all of it. But we're going to look at the most important and relevant parts. But so there's a number of announcements. So hopefully everyone's working on homework four. I've seen some activity on the mailing group, so that's good. That's due a week from today, any time. Does anyone have any questions on writing any of the shaders or any of the written stuff? How's it going? Pretty well so far. Looks like some people are almost done. If you're working on bump map, then you must be almost done. Okay, so I guess maybe the biggest announcement is, believe it or not, the project is 6 weeks total, right? As of today, we're 2 weeks into it. So that's one third of your time in. So you should think, are you one third done? You guys are smiling over there, right? So, and I know, you know, I certainly encourage everyone to hit it hard and early, and I know that sometimes that doesn't always happen. So if you're not one third done now, you know, perhaps your acceleration will be very steep in the coming weeks. But a week from now, we're going to start presentations, midpoint presentations. I was just going to use that Monday, but we have 18 projects, so that would be like 4 minutes each. And it's not enough time. So we're going to do a full 5 minutes plus some overhead for switching. So we're going to have both Monday and Wednesday next week these presentations for your project. We will still do student presentations on Wednesday. So you might have to present twice, possibly. I won't tell you if you're presenting your project Monday or Wednesday because that'd be an unfair advantage if I gave you an extra 2 days to put together your slides. So you'll just send me your slides, or put your slides on your blog anytime Sunday night, this coming Sunday. And you can present it however you want. Like, say you have some code that's working, you can get up and just show your code and not have any slides. I don't care. You can put together a video. It's totally up to you. In fact, I can't tell you how many presentations I've given where I come in and I go, I don't have any slides, and they love it. And people are like, oh, you don't have any slides? That's great. You know, it's just a demo. So if you're at that, if you really think you can pull that off, you should do it. And I'm not going to be, oh my God, there's no slides, minus 50. No, it doesn't matter. What else about that? And I sent out a good video from these two open source guys at Google on them co-presenting. You just watch a couple minutes of it. These guys are amazing. Like, the way that they present together, I have never seen anything like it in my life. So if you could recreate, so if you have a partner, and you could recreate something even close to that, that'd be pretty awesome. They're very good. Okay, so tell me, what questions do you guys have about doing the midpoint presentations? It's just 5 minutes. Show me where you are. Show me where you're going. Please have something. Please have more than your proposal by that point. Okay. So homework five, I was going to hand out this Monday, but I think I'm going to push it back another week. Homework five is going to be small. It's going to be small and experimental. The details of the experiment will be released soon once I figure out those, but it's going to be a very cutting-edge assignment in the way that we do it in this class. It's, you know, it may be a homework that you've never done a homework like this before, and then I'll need the class's feedback as a whole to see if I should do that in the coming semesters. Okay, so here's one thing I need your help with. Yep?
Just out of curiosity, you mentioned that the last time you taught this, the cutting edge assignment was read space and the gym, right?
Yes.
Would we be allowed to have a look at the code from that class as well? Just if we're interested in.
In the screen, and like, yeah. You want to see the answer for screen space and ambient occlusion?
Not necessarily the answer.
Just the assignment?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's already.
It's figured out.
Yeah, it's online.
It seems like a cool.
Yeah, it was a good assignment. If you Google, on our website, in fact, I'll just bring it up right now. You guys can see it. So part of our website says previous semesters, and then right here, if you go to spring 2012, under the homeworks, it's up there as a advanced GLSO. You can just download it. It's right there. I don't remove this stuff from previous semesters, and I guess some instructors do. I don't care if you go up there and then look at it. That would be perfectly fine with me. So please have at that. Any other questions regarding the homework? Okay, so what I want to ask about is, we have twice as many students now this semester as I had last spring, or almost twice as many. It was only like 12 last spring. I feel this semester we're a little tight with the student presentations. Like I feel, definitely like it's hard to get into 20, 25 minutes. And I also feel some of my lectures, I'm very much like, we got to go, or we're just going to cover less. But I feel that student presentations are so important. Like you really need that experience presenting, and then you have that slides that you can show to employers, or if you decide to make the video, you have that as well. So I'm trying to figure out what I should do for future semesters, right? One idea is that we kind of teach this course twice, in the fall and in the spring, and say in the fall it's really focused on graphics, and in the spring it's really focused on general architecture, parallel programming, compute. And we're not going to fully remove graphics from the compute version or compute from the graphics version. It might be like an 80-20 split. So I need feedback from you guys informally right now to tell me if we think that's a bad idea or if that's a good idea. So give me some ideas. What do you guys think? Carl? Yeah, so down the road, you can imagine that this class should really split. It should be a real-time rendering class for the graphics people, and it should be a massively parallel programming class for non-graphics. Now, could you take it twice? I would say the answer is probably no. I don't know. Maybe no. Maybe I don't know like how the politics work. If like you take it twice, but the second time you take it counts as an independent study or something. But that's a good point. But this coming year, it would still be CIS 565. The numbers wouldn't split yet.
Because the at least what I think is that sort of throughout the course of what we've already done, so like 277, 460, and then 565, and then whatever else we've taken, sort of we get like this sort of in every single class we get this sort of like what's the term? Yeah, kind of like this quick, incomplete, like quick overview. Like, okay, here's how you do OpenGL. BBOs, yeah, okay, like let's get that out of the way as quickly as possible. So like what happens is we see like the whole concept of BBOs, or whatever, we see it like several times, and each time it's not very comprehensively covered. The same with like GLSL, we see it a couple of times, but we never see it comprehensively covered. So it would be cool to have. Like, and then the cool thing about 560, is that already it's like by far the most detailed, comprehensive view of like real-time rendering that we've ever had. And it would be interesting to like,
but it's still not as comprehensive as I think it can be. Right.
It'd be interesting to see more of like the more advanced stuff, like the whole like screen space ambient
right.
Time subsurface scattering and all these like sort of more advanced, more like sort of game engine relevant things.
Mm-hmm.
Since a lot of what we see other classes is more relevant to offline.
Okay. Yeah, that's good feedback, good advice. I would like to make this, from the graphics point of view, the class that I wanted to take, in 2006. I mean, it was good when I took it in 2006. So let me hear from Christian, your computer engineering, right? Or computer science, but your focus is architecture. So what would you think if this course were to split its focus fall and spring?
I think that would be fine, especially for people like myself that could take the more not have to worry so much about a graphics background. Because, I mean, this like surface stuff is fine. It's easy to understand. But if you got much deeper, then that would be tough for me to come in and take a course like this.
Okay. Nana, you're in embedded systems, right? What would you think if the focus of this class split?
I think actually a lot of them would actually take this course out there. I mean, I've talked to some junior embedded systems, master's. They were scared about the graphics part, and I told them it's not that bad. But I
because I've gotten at least 3 emails in the past week from embedded system students asking me, can I handle the graphics? And I go, I don't know, maybe. Okay, so tell me, give me an argument for no, this class should stay the way it is, where it's really the full spectrum of GPU. Does anyone have an argument for that? That's not playing devil's advocate, because I could play devil's advocate, certainly, but does anyone feel strongly that, hey, that would be the wrong move and that we should keep it with this blend of compute and graphics?
Well, I feel like something that's good for your grads, this might not be as true, but I feel like something that's good for grad students who have had more experience, something that's good for us as undergrads is that since we haven't had much exposure to graphics, like GeoMx and stuff, and we have had good exposure to CUDA, taking the course sort of like introduces a lot of this stuff to us very quickly. So because of, you know, how it's all sort of like everything is right now. So we learn a lot of this very quickly, which means that we can start applying it extremely quickly. And I think that's like,
there's something to be said for that. Yeah. Man, you argue both sides of the coin here. So say I would probably have like 4 lectures for graphics in the compute class and 4 lectures for compute in the graphic class, something like that. So I think that you'd still see everything. You just wouldn't be as focused in one area. You know, like for example, some of the things like bank conflicts and memory partitioning that Varun went over, we may not do that in the graphics version. And then likewise, here, I don't know, what have we talked about graphics-wise? It's been complicated. I would say nothing yet. But you can imagine something like screen space aim and occlusion, which still isn't that complicated, wouldn't make it into the compute version. Okay, well, yeah, so email me if you guys have any other ideas, but it sounded like a pretty good thing, and I don't know how hard this is for me to get the department to do it, but they seem to be open to the idea. So, okay, well, let's jump in. We'll spend a little bit of time, like I say, talking about OpenGL today. I'm going to focus on the API for launching shaders and setting uniforms on shaders, and then the other part of OpenGL, which we're going to do hopefully tomorrow or Wednesday, will be on an efficient buffer usage, which is really, we fill up Vertex data into these buffers and we send them to the video card. It's not that simple. It sounds that simple, but there's a lot to it if you want to really push a lot of data to the video card and make your rendering efficient. Okay, so I know we've been looking at GLSL, which is the shading language for OpenGL, but the API itself is C-based, so it's not C++, it's straight C, and we're going to see that in a lot of its design. Right, it's cross-platform, so it runs on Linux, Mac, Windows. You'll see it on the embedded versions with OpenGL ES. You'll see it on the handhelds. And it's run by the ARB. And it's that you say ARB, you don't say ARB. I said ARB for the longest time until I met people on the ARB, and they called the ARB, so it's called the ARB, the Architecture Review Board, which is part of the Kronos group. So literally, OpenGL is an open graphics library. It's an open standard for doing graphics, and it is not ran by any one company. It's not like Microsoft who has Direct3D and they just control Direct3D. It's ran by a bunch of different people that are part of the Kronos group. You have people from Intel, NVIDIA, AMD, Transgaming, Blizzard, I mean, you name it, there's a lot of people in there. Now, of course, as we talked about briefly with CUDA versus OpenCL, this means that they don't necessarily move as quickly as Direct3D. Sometimes you'll see features come out in Direct3D before they come out in OpenGL. But sometimes you'll see features come out in OpenGL first as an extension, because a vendor, say I work for AMD and I have partial resident textures. That's a new thing that just came out, although I don't know where it stands in terms of the extensions. But you can just say, okay, there's a new feature in my hardware, and I'm going to make an OpenGL extension. It just works on AMD, and I put it out there right away. So it's available to OpenGL programmers using your card, but it's actually not part of OpenGL. It needs to go through this process to become part of OpenGL. And then, of course, OpenGL hides the underlying hardware and the device drivers, right? Like, I know very little about exactly how the device driver works or how the hardware software interface interacts, but I program OpenGL, which under the hood takes care of all that. So as I mentioned before, we're really focusing on, say, the core features of OpenGL 2, or which is basically the same as OpenGL ES 2. So everything that we're seeing in these slides, we can see both on the desktop and on the mobile versions. We're not doing any of this fixed function shading like we introduced with that light map example. And we're not using any of these legacy API calls. How many people recognize these calls from somewhere other than my slides earlier? Most people, yeah. We've got to change these earlier courses in our curriculum. So this GL begin, that's something that's used for immediate mode, where you literally describe one vertex at a time when you're drawing. And it's horrendously inefficient. And last semester I went over all the different ways that we used to submit geometry to the video card, a history of immediate mode and display lists and client-side arrays and all this stuff. This is so irrelevant today that I'm not even going to go over the history. Like, this is the only part of the history that you're going to get, and we're only going to show you the best way to do it and the most standard way. And then these things like GL rotate. That used to say, you used to be able to say, okay, here's my model matrix, and I want to do a rotation, 30 degrees around some axis. And that was part of the OpenGL API. But it wasn't hardware accelerated. It makes no sense, actually, to hardware accelerate just creating that matrix. So since it's not, OpenGL is supposed to expose the underlying hardware. So things like this got pulled out of the API. Like GL Rotate F does not exist in OpenGL Core Profile. However, it does exist in something called Compatibility Profile, and all the vendors still implement Compatibility Profile. So you can still use it, but if you're writing new code, don't even think about it. Like, don't go near it.
On OS 10, or the newest version of OS 10, if you use OpenGL 3.2, you can only use the core profile, because Apple doesn't.
They don't. Apple doesn't do that.
Apple doesn't expose the compatible profile for 3.2 and up.
That's good news. I completely agree with them. So we're only looking at really the core features here. And then, we already talked about it. I remember I said that there used to be something called the alpha test, but now that you can do that with discard and a fragment shader, that's an irrelevant piece of the fixed function that was removed. Like I said, the OpenGL API sits on top of the device driver, so we just program the API. It theoretically works on multiple video cards from multiple vendors. AMD and NVIDIA are pretty solid. A few years ago, I didn't think AMD drivers, OpenGL drivers, are that great, but they've done incredible work recently, and their drivers are really pretty good now. And then Intel, I guess, is still up in the air. I've been fortunate enough to avoid running on Intel cards recently, but it's still, I don't think they're that great yet still, so we'll see. Hopefully moving forward, they will be. Making an OpenGL driver, by the way, is very hard. Like, it's not as easy as, as you'd want it to be or think it is. And it is so important for a vendor to have their driver run quickly, because I want to say that my hardware runs Rage faster than anyone else's hardware. So they literally have heuristics in the hardware and the driver that goes, well, how are they using OpenGL? And then they change what they do under the hood. And I can't necessarily confirm this, but I can almost confirm that they'll even look to see what game is running. They'll be like, oh, that's World of Warcraft 3. Enter this special mode. Like, they'll seriously have special cases for individual code. They try to avoid it, but I'm pretty sure that they do that in certain cases. So in OpenGL, the major abstractions that we look at are shader programs and shader objects. A shader object corresponds to one stage of the pipeline that we can program. So it's either a vertex shader or a fragment shader in OpenGL 2. And a shader program links those two together. And we're going to look at that process today. Array buffers and element buffers, these are how we get geometry to the video card. You may hear these things called vertex buffers or vertex buffer objects. And that's what I used to call them, but that's like the old name. And I got in a lot of trouble for saying that. So now I call them array buffers for restoring vertices, and element buffers for storing indices. Frame buffers here are what we wind up drawing to, what the output of the fragment shader is. And you can attach textures to those, which is really cool, because what you can do is you can render to a frame buffer that has a texture on it. And then in the next pass, you can read from that texture. And you can do lots of effects, multiple pass effects there, where the output of one pass is the input to the next pass. And there's also something called render buffers, which are not as useful as textures, but they're still there. Pixel buffers are used for storing, well, they're actually not in OpenGL ES, unfortunately, but they're in OpenGL desktop, and they're used for transferring pixel data to and from the video card, a lot of times used for asynchronous transfers for textures. And then there's some fixed function state, turn on the depth test, turn on the stencil test, set the depth function to less than, et cetera, et cetera. And like I said, we're just going to hit the high points here. Once you see the flow of the API, you can rip right through the SDK. Oh, man, I forgot to show you guys something. Here's another question I had for you guys. This is the potential cover for my upcoming book that I did with Christoph. I think I told you guys about this, right? This is the book. We didn't actually write this book. We're editors, and we recruited about 50 or so authors to write individual topics on OpenGL, WebGL, OpenGL ES. Really a community-based book, just like you see in GPU gems or game programming gems. And Christoph, he's a lot more artistic than I am, as you guys can see. He made this cover, sent it to me last night. What do you guys think about this cover?
Is that the one scene that's supposed to be
Yeah, this scene is very popular.
I don't know what it's called, but I see it.
What's it called?
Sposa or something like that.
Yeah, that could be it. So yeah, this is actually rendered from the order. There's a chapter we have on order independent translucency, and that's what this is rendered. It's shown different layers of translucency, and then he's got the way that he breaks it up. It's like some famous decomposition method. Yep.
Most of these times, text it being white and small makes it difficult to read.
Yeah. I think I agree. I agree with you. I wonder if we can do a drop shadow or something. And pretty soon I'm going to have to credit you guys for the cover for the cover design by CIS565.
Why don't you just put it under the OpenGL?
What do you mean?
Your name.
Yeah, that's a possibility, too. That's a good idea. We'll see. Christoph was almost like, no, we don't even want to put our names on it. And, you know, I don't really need my name on it, but I also feel that, like, if you pick up a book, you go, who wrote this? And then you can't figure out who wrote it, you know? So, like, I think it should be on the cover.
You can make your name as a texture on Flutter.
Yeah, we could do that. That'd be creative. But, yeah, we'll see. We'll iterate on this, and it'll be exciting. And as you can see, this book has not gone to the printer yet because we don't have the cover yet. And we're going to do this by SIGGRAPH, which is first week of August. And you can see it's almost April, right? So, and the printing process takes a while, so it's going to be crunch time soon. All right, that's enough asides. Okay, so like I said, a shader object, it just represents one shader stage, vertex shader, fragment shader, and you compile the source code. So it's like you can think of it just like an object if you're writing C++ code, and you create objects and you link those objects together. And then the shader program is when you actually do the linking. And let me show you guys some code. Now this code has already been written for you in homework 4, but here we're gonna create a shader object. It's gonna be for a vertex shader. So here I'm saying GL create vertex shader, or create shader, and I'm saying make me a vertex shader. One line of code, right? GL, not even underscore. Why do these things all start with GL? Yep.
So you don't conflict with other function
names? Yeah, it's just a naming convention, because if it was create shader, that may very well conflict with a name in your own application. So in C++, we'd have namespaces, and we could have an OpenGL namespace, but in C, we don't have namespaces, so they start everything with GL. Now here, this return thing, this GLUint, this unsigned integer, that's an opaque object. Like you go, oh, it's an integer. I don't know what it is, right? It could be a pointer. It could be, more likely, it's an index into an array, or it could be a map, and that's an opaque data type. We don't care about the details. We're not going to explicitly muck with it. We're really just going to pass that to other OpenGL functions. And in C++, you know, this would probably return an object, right? And we'd have a class that defines the vertex shader, or the shader in general. Okay, so this line of code is interesting. Here, we're actually giving it our shader source code. So our source code is in a string. I had up at the top line, const char, star, source equals whatever. And then here I'm saying the shader source for V, for that vertex shader, I'm giving it one array of strings, and then I give it the string, and then the string's length. Now you might look at this, and you probably have 100 questions here, right? Where does the source come from? You can, if you want, you could code your shaders as strings inside your C++ code. You probably can't write more than like a 5-line shader doing that before you get annoyed. So it's very common that we write the shader in a separate file, and we can make the extension whatever we want. .glsl, I think, is what I used in your homework, but there's really no standard. I recommend using .glsl, but you can use, you know, .vs, .fs for vertex shader, frag and shader, .vert, .frag, it's really up to you. And then at runtime, we can load that file and give it to this function. Visual Studio and most environments also have a way to embed resources, so you can actually embed that string inside your executable and then pull that string out and give it to the shader source function. But there's no like built-in, it's really up to you to manage this string. And then you might really, like this API looks a little goofy at first, you might go, well, geez, why can I give it multiple strings? Why don't I just give it one string? You know, why is this thing, it looks so verbose, this thing, why isn't this thing less code? So you can give it multiple strings because you might have multiple strings for different parts of your shader. Mainly, you might be making a library. Like a lot of the engine that I work on, we have a whole library for doing constructive solid geometry. We have all these intersection tests and just number crunching. And that will be in its own string. And then here, you can give it a separate string that just has your main function, that has your actual shader, not your library. Now, you'll see in WebGL, actually, you can only give it one string, and you have to concatenate them, and then use that #0 that I showed you guys last week, so you can get correct line numbers out when you get errors. Okay, so once you create your shader, you give it source, you can compile it. This compile doesn't really do anything. Like, compile doesn't actually compile it. What happens is compile will verify that the code is correct. It will build like an abstract syntax tree or something under the hood. But it doesn't actually compile until you ask it to link. Because it looks at both the vertex shader and the fragment shader, and then it will optimize those depending on the communication between them. So the compile, like if you do some timing, you'll see that this runs very quickly, where your link might take longer, because this, like I said, is just very quick. It just doesn't do as much work as you'd think. And the spec allows that. Like the OpenGL spec is, I don't want to use the word vague enough, but I'll say it's vague enough that it allows the compile to really just check for syntax errors. Okay, so here, this is optional, but it's highly encouraged. I'm doing this GL get shader where I'm saying, tell me the compile status. Did it compile or did it have syntax errors? Here. And you'll see generally GL gets are slow. One example I can tell you for this API here is that if I do this GL get and I say, did it compile or not? We had to have built that syntax tree. We would have had to check the syntax. Now, if I didn't do this, for all you know, GL compile shader is asynchronous. That went off and it returned immediately, but since we didn't actually use V, since we didn't actually use the shader after we compiled it, it actually didn't have to compile, didn't have to do anything. And like I said, it compiles fast, but the link part, that's where all the work is done. So this is actually more important for the link part. But just so you know, yeah, the OpenGL can be that tricky under the hood. And so that's one reason why GL get can have performance implications. Other types of get calls can have performance implications as well. And then you're going to use this shader, you know, throughout the lifetime of your application, especially like if you look at your homework 4 and you're doing that vertex shader wave. You're going to use this shader, and then once the program closes, finally all you do is GL delete shader to free it up. Okay, so we'll stop here for now, but on Wednesday, we're going to look at taking these shader objects and linking them together into the shader program and then setting the uniforms. I know a number of you have probably already set the uniforms for vertex shader in homework 4. It's just a couple lines of code. I pretty much give you the lines of code. You can just copy and paste them, but you guys should just be basically sending in that scalar value for the time, right? Okay, before we switch to student presentations, any questions? Okay, good. All right, so